parents who are so desperate not to say no to their kids are now outsourcing this problem to the therapy profession.
The school counselors, the school psychologists, were so undermining parents' confidence in their, they weren't trusting themselves. And in fact, since I've written the book, I am inundated with letters from parents thanking me that they don't have to feel guilty anymore when they punish a child for bad behavior. See, the therapeutic experts had so convinced them that they would traumatize the kid if they took away their smartphone or engaged in any other discipline, that parents were afraid to do it.
Today, we're privileged to host Abigail Schreier once again, a Yale-educated journalist and author whose incisive critique of modern sociocultural trends has positioned her at the forefront of some of today's most heated debates. Abigail Schreier's career trajectory is as impressive as it has been impactful. After obtaining her undergrad degree from Columbia University, she further honed her critical thinking skills at Oxford University, where she delved into philosophy. Following her time at Oxford, Abigail attended Yale Law School, where she not only mastered the intricacies of law, but also developed a keen sense for the underlying societal implications of legal standards and practices. After law school, Abigail embarked on a career in journalism, quickly establishing herself as a forthright, incisive commentator whose work often challenges mainstream perspectives. Abigail first captured widespread attention with her provocative book, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters, where she explored the complexities and rapid increase in transgender identification among teenage girls. Since her last appearance, Abigail has not shied away from controversy, but rather plunged deeper into the tumultuous waters of public discourse with her latest book, Bad Therapy. Released in February, this new work examines the burgeoning crisis in mental health therapy, focusing on the potential harms of emerging therapeutic practices and ideologies that prioritize affirmation over critical assessment and care. Today, she brings her rigorous analysis back to our show to explore the increasing obsession with mental health in the public school system, the implications of new parenting techniques that undermine parental confidence, and the potential dangers of overvalidating every emotion children express. We'll tackle how these educational and parenting approaches not only fail to equip children for real-world challenges, but may also perpetuate a cycle of dependency and fragility. Abigail's background in law and journalism equips her with a unique lens through which to analyze the intersections of policy, culture, and personal experience. Insights that are crucial for anyone concerned with the future of our society and the well-being of the next generation. So, buckle up as we prepare for a conversation filled with critical analysis, insightful commentary, and the fearless pursuit of truth. This is the Sunday Special. Abigail, thanks so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here. Great to talk to you, Ben.
So let's talk about what's ailing the kids. Why don't we start from the sort of Jonathan Haidt proposition that there started to be this massive uptick around 2010, 2011, 2012 with regard to suicidal ideation rates. He traces that to the ubiquity of social media, to cell phones, to the ability of teenagers particularly to have all of this instant feedback in perverse echo chambers. You really say in your book that it's much more about the sort of therapies that we've been using for kids who are troubled. The kids have always been troubled. It's just there's been a systemic change in therapy. What do you make of Haidt's theory, and how does it contrast with your own?
Right. So, you know, there's a lot of agreement between me and Haidt. Honestly, there's way more agreement than disagreement. I think, and my last book was about a social contagion spread largely by influencers on social media, right? I'm very aware of the danger of how bad social media has been for young people, including their mental health. And I agree, and I wholeheartedly support his effort to get them out of schools. I think that's a no-brainer. It's something we've known is bad for kids, and having them on their phones in school is just really doesn't make any sense. And there are a lot of harms that come from it. Okay. But does it totally explain the mental health decline of young people? No, it clearly doesn't. Let me just give you one statistic, although I can give you a few, but let me give you one. In 2016, according to the CDC, 2016, one in six American kids between the ages of 2 and 8 had a mental health or behavioral diagnosis. Those kids, these are little kids, they weren't on social media. They're not on social media now, but they definitely weren't back in 2016. But also, if you look across countries, look at countries like Israel, okay, Japan. The youth are all on their phones in these countries. In fact, in Israel, they give smartphones to kids younger than they do in America. But their mental health in terms of anxiety and depression is better. And the reason is because it isn't just a question of the phones. It's also a question of the unhealthy life we've given kids, which includes this constant therapy, this constant sense from schools, from parents, and yes, from therapists, that there's something wrong with them, that they have trauma, and that they need a diagnosis and medication.
So let's talk about that with regard to specifically young kids, then we'll sort of move up the age chain here. Sure. So when we talk about kids that you're talking about, the kids who are 2 to 8, and the sort of mass therapy that has now been, you know, foisted upon these kids, the overdiagnosis of these kids, it seems like two separate phenomena for boys and for girls. For boys, there's always been a sort of over-medicalization of boyhood. This goes back to the 1990s, this idea that if a boy can't sit still, which if you've ever met a young boy, they literally cannot sit still. They're just motoring around all the time. That somehow represents a break from normality and must be medicalized. And that for young girls, insecurity, which again is kind of normal among young girls, that is also a medical issue. What do you see in terms of the over-medicalization? Which are the things that have been treated as medical problems when in reality, they're just failures, for example, of parenting or structure?
So shyness. We never hear a kid described as shy. They have social phobia or social anxiety, right? Every child who's inattentive is told they have ADHD. And by the way, they're often told by the teachers. No one's checking to see if the teacher is particularly good or if the lesson is particularly interesting to a five-year-old boy. No, the child has ADHD and they refer him to for treatment. And this goes on from phobias, all these things, testing anxiety. If a child is defiant, he has oppositional defiant disorder. It couldn't possibly be a problem of character or, you know, discipline. So everything has become sort of therapized. We've all been bathed in therapy. And normal behaviors, unfortunately, are not only diagnosed, but what we do is we make all these things worse by accommodating them. The second we are told a child, a teacher says, or a child says she might have nervousness about tests, she's taken to a therapist, she's diagnosed with testing anxiety. And what does the school counselor do? They accommodate it. They give her more time on the test. Well, now it's become a problem for life. You just turned what might have been a short-term problem into a chronic one.
So let's talk about the therapy that's applied. So there's really two problems. One is the overdiagnosis, then one is the therapy that's applied. So as you say, there's a label that has to be put on everything in order to justify the therapy. So if a kid is being a brat, yelling at adults or whatever, this now becomes oppositional defiant disorder, for example. What therapy is then applied? Because there are a bunch of different types of therapy and they are not the same by any stretch of the imagination. When it comes to things like, for example, OCD, there's exposure therapies that are quite effective in terms of getting kids to change their behavior with regard to a thing that's very difficult for them. But then there's therapies like talk therapy that are completely ineffective. Which therapies are good? Which therapies are bad? Are all therapies to be treated the same here?
So there are two things. So what I'm concerned about is not therapy in response to a problem. When an intervention, if a child has anorexia, if they have severe OCD, if they have a severe phobia, there are really good therapies, like, as you said, exposure therapy, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. And what a therapist will do is they address the problem and they actually measure that the child's getting better. But that's not the majority of what we're talking about. What I'm talking about is so-called preventive mental health care, which we've never been good at. That is treating kids who don't have a significant problem. We're doing this through public schools, through things like social emotional learning. Parents are plying kids with these techniques. They're reading the best-selling parenting books, all written by therapists, and they're plying with these kids with these constant focus on their emotions. Think about your emotions. And that is leading to more dysregulated kids. But as you said, therapies for things like phobias and OCD, they're very good. They might even be essential.
So let's talk for a second about the parents in all of this. So in this equation, we've talked about the kids, we've talked about the therapist, but it is the parent who's supposed to be the guardian of their kids from this sort of stuff. And there does seem to be, if we're going to talk about the narcissism of the modern generation, we may be focusing on the wrong generation. We may be focusing on young people who can't take care of themselves, their kids, but it's their parents who are really the problem. Because it used to be that if your kid failed in a particular way, your first thought was reflexive. What did I do? What could I change about my behavior that would maybe change the behavior of my kid? If a teacher came to you and complained about your kid in class, the move wouldn't be to then respond by either medicalizing the kid or by saying that the teacher did something wrong. It might be to say, okay, what am I doing wrong as a parent that I can change at home to actually drill some sense into my kid? And now it seems as though parents are outsourcing the problems to everybody else. If you medicalize a problem, then obviously it's not your fault that the problem is occurring. It's a medical problem. And if that problem can only be solved by a third party, like a therapist, then that prevents you as a parent from having to actually do the hard work necessary in order to curb your child's behavior, which is the most unpleasant part of parenting. I mean, you're a parent, I'm a parent. The worst part of parenting is saying no. Kids, of course, yes. think that the worst part of saying parent, that your parents love saying no to you. They want to say no. Saying no to your kids is like the worst thing in the entire world, especially because, I mean, to be frank, kids are really, really stupid when they're little. And so you'll tell them, if you do A, then B will happen. And then they will do A and B will happen. And they'll get very angry at you and upset with you and say, I didn't want B to happen either. That was why I made the threat. That is why I told you about this conditional statement, if A, then B. But parents who are so desperate not to say no to their kids are now outsourcing this problem to the therapy profession.
Right. So I started the book with that hypothesis. I thought it had to do with the way they were being raised. I noticed that parents were very gentle with their kids. They didn't want to say no. They were always asking their kids for input on the job they were doing. This is so-called gentle parenting, or what I call therapeutic parenting, because it's very feelings focused. It's very, you know, abjuring your own authority and focusing on your child's feelings. Okay. But why do I ultimately not think this is because parents were driving it? So what I realized, and part of the, I realized this after I did an investigation into the schools, what I realized is that they had all these mental health experts at your kid's school. Very often that's the place where most mental health experts are the most aggressive. The school counselors, the school psychologists, were so undermining parents' confidence in they weren't trusting themselves. And in fact, since I've written the book, I am inundated with letters from parents thanking me that they don't have to feel guilty anymore when they punish a child for bad behavior. See, the therapeutic experts had so convinced them that they would traumatize the kid if they took away their smartphone or engaged in any other discipline, that parents were afraid to do it.
You know, this is one of the problems you've been discussing throughout your career, particularly in your last book and also in this book. This cult of expertise that so many people have given into. And of course, we all use heuristic shortcuts throughout life because we can't all be experts on everything. I mean, if you've got a medical problem, of course you're going to go to a doctor. You didn't go to medical school. But when we decide that there is a class of experts, and these experts actually have an ulterior motive in maximizing their own importance, in maximizing the scope of their own jurisdiction, it makes it very difficult for parents to shy away from that. If you get a call from a school therapist saying your kid has oppositional defiant disorder, for example, you don't know what the hell they're talking about. You think that's an actual disorder that is commonly applied and that the therapist has some sort of objective metric that can be used in order to obtain that diagnosis. And only when you dig into things, do you realize that, well, maybe the metric that's being used for the diagnosis is inherently vague. Maybe it turns out that there's really no great way to diagnose this problem. And it's just a label being put on a certain set of behaviors that really doesn't apply.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you're not even getting a call from the school therapist. You're getting it from the teacher. And the teacher's giving a diagnosis. And the pediatrician is recommending SSRIs. In both cases, not things they're qualified to do. Psychiatric medication is really not the purview of the pediatrician. But nonetheless, people are feeling free to diagnose people's kids and encourage them on a path to medication for things that none of them are qualified really to assess. And I'll just say one other thing. You know, it isn't just that they hand out the diagnosis. When a teacher calls a parent, they don't say your child is acting up. They will tell them your child probably may have ADHD. But there's something else too. Nobody stops and says, what am I doing in the environment? What's going on in the environment that's maybe making things harder for my child? Like, am I handing him an iPad in the morning before school? Things like that. Am I not disciplining the child? Am I never saying no? Is the first time he ever hears the word no from his teacher? Well, no wonder he's not listening to the teacher.
We'll get to more on this in just one moment. First, my days are incredibly full. Between the show, being a dad, and various other responsibilities, I can't keep up with my day if I don't get a good night's sleep, which is why I appreciate my Helix mattress. Helix harnesses years of mattress expertise to offer a truly elevated sleep experience. That Helix Elite collection includes 6 different mattress models, each tailored for specific sleep positions and firmness preferences. If you're nervous about buying a mattress online, you really don't have to be. Helix has a sleep quiz that matches your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress. Because why would you buy a mattress made for somebody else? I took that Helix quiz. I was matched with a firm but breathable mattress. I love it. My wife loves it. We are big Helix fans at the Shapiro household. Plus, Helix has a 10-year warranty. You have to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it, but you will. Helix's financing options and flexible payment plans make it so a great night's sleep is never far away. Helix is offering up to 30% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for my listeners. Just head on over to helixsleep.com/men. It's their best offer yet. It won't last long. helixsleep.com/men with Helix. Better sleep starts right now. We've been using Helix for years. You're going to love it the same way we do. Check it out right now. helixsleep.com/men. So, you know, we've now had years of experience of the over-therapization of kids. And what are the results? I mean, you talk obviously about the level of diagnostics, the level of therapy, and obviously we see the rising levels of suicidality. I guess the counter argument, if I were going to try to steel man the position, would be that this always existed in the population. We're just noticing it now. Right? It's the same argument that's very frequently used whenever you have a social contagion, is the idea that it was always there. One fifth of people were always LGBTQ plus. It's just that only now are we noticing it and giving freedom to people to be what they want to be. It turns out that 1/6 of kids were always diagnosably mentally ill or had some sort of mental disorder. It's just only now are we getting the therapeutic tools necessary in order to properly diagnose and create therapies for them. How do you counter those sorts of arguments?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a really good argument. And let me just say, you know, to steel man it further, adolescent mental health has been in steady decline since the 1950s. It's been a precipitous decline in this country, which, by the way, is why I don't think social media entirely explains it. We have seen this steep downward trend, okay? Although, you know, I do think social media made things worse, absolutely. But why do I think that it isn't just more awareness of poor mental health? Because it isn't just people, you know, getting diagnosed. It's people, we're seeing more rumination. This is the number one symptom of depression, more rehashing of bad feelings, focusing on your pain, talking about your trauma. That itself is a symptom of depression. Just their willingness to constantly talk about it. But also, they're not showing up for work because of minor problems. They're not showing up for work because they feel traumatized because they don't like the president who was elected. And they're not faking it. These are kids who have been conditioned to be so focused on their feelings that their feelings are predictably, and I show this through, you know, through the interviews with experts, you know, genuine psychological research, it shows if you focus on your feelings too much, you will become dysregulated. And that's what we're seeing. These kids are walking around focused on their feelings, and their feelings are constantly out of whack.
So, you know, the sort of place that you've chosen to put your lens, obviously, is on the medical industry, on the therapy industry, and all the rest. But if you move beneath that, you mentioned, for example, the trend of teenage angst and problems in teenagers going all the way back to the 1950s. Emil Durkheim suggested that anomie was a problem going back to the late 19th century. This basic idea that as societies became unembedded, that as people became unglued from their social structures, from family, from church, from community, that you would end up with greater anomie, greater depression is what he was predicting. I mean, he wrote an entire book called On Suicide that was effectively about this. Is that what we're actually seeing society-wide, and now it's just being turned into sort of medical language?
Yes, I totally agree with that. So I believe we are giving kids increasingly unhealthy lives, and then we pour in the mental health resources, and we're baffled that they're not helping. They're not helping because, exactly as you said, kids are detached from community. They're detached from family. And by the way, the psychological literature, if people bothered to read it, and I mean the mental health professionals, if they bothered to read it, they would say that it supports all this. Kids need to be engaged in something bigger than themselves. They do very well with outward focus, feeling connected to family, having a certain amount of independence, which, yes, includes some amount of risk and danger. So, you know, a trip to the store or being able to cook for themselves, things that involve some danger. These things are so good for kids, and it's what we're not giving them. By the way, I thought you were going to say fatherlessness. This is like the big thing that conservatives always bring up. Well, she completely ignores fatherlessness. I don't ignore fatherlessness. Of course, you know, any kind of family instability, including lack of fathers, has had a profound impact on kids. But the thing to know is that a lot of the, you know, poor mental health has coincided with fathers being present. It really has. Some of the kids who are the most diagnosed have fathers present. And I know that from my last book, in which I talked to probably 1,000 families, and the vast majority of them had intact family structures. What they didn't have is parents who were willing to exercise authority and say, no, you're not a boy, you're a girl.
I mean, and what you're talking about there is something that goes deeper than fatherlessness in sort of the technical sense that there's not a father in the home. It's that there is a role called father. And if no one is playing the role of father, you effectively do have a fatherless family. If the father is playing mom, exactly. I mean, it used to be, and in the typical, you know this, of course, because you're Jewish, but the typical Judaic framework is that the masculine attribute is justice and the feminine attribute is mercy. And you do see that in the house a lot. In our house, you know, the reality is that if you want real empathy, you're probably going to go to mommy. And when the bleep hits the fan, it's daddy who's coming down with the hammer. And if daddy never comes down with the hammer, then you do have a real problem on your hands, particularly when it comes to teenage boys. I mean, once you get to teenage boys are simply not going to listen to mom when she sets down the rules. It really is going to have to be dad who does that. And if dad doesn't do that, well, then what's the impact of having a man in the house who refuses to actually set the rules in any way, shape, or form? You know, one of the things that you talked about there also is the idea that kids need an orientation outside of themselves. And what's amazing to me is that everything you're talking about is so commonsensical to people who actually have kids. And so one of the things that I'm wondering is whether as we as a society have fewer and fewer children, and as the people who are in positions of power in these various industries, many of them don't have kids at all. Many of them don't have traditional family structures at all. And they're in charge of the education of our children. I mean, the heads of the teachers' unions are not married couples with four kids. They're very often lesbian couples with no kids or lesbian couples with an adopted kid. I mean, that's the story with, I believe, Randy Weingarten, for example, over at the American Federation of Teachers. That's a very different way of viewing how family structure is supposed to work. And so if you're structuring all of teaching around sort of your own anecdotal experience, you're going to end up with a lack of experience in areas that's really necessary. I know for me, on a Sunday morning, if my kids are not out of the house by 9:30 oriented toward a task, they will start clawing at each other like immediately. Because they need a thing to do, and kids need a thing to do, but we're not giving kids a thing to do. We're telling kids that they ought to be coddled because we've told adults that they ought to be coddled, and now we're treating adults like kids and kids like small adults, effectively.
Yeah, you said so many interesting things. So first of all, authority. Yes, somebody has to be the authority in the home. I don't necessarily think it has to be the father, but somebody has to be the authority, which, yes, means willingness to punish. But what you said about the subversions of fathers is right. I think men have changed the most. Fathers have changed the most in the last generation. And here's what I mean. It isn't just that they won't punish. It's the way they will even talk to their kids. They're aping the same therapist moms are. So for instance, no one says to a child, no one, shake it off, you're fine. You almost never hear shake it off. You almost never hear sticks and stones anymore, or you'll live. Right? So no one is telling kids, even at a small level, that they can overcome minor injuries. So they don't think they can.
Yeah. Well, one of the phrases that's been banned in our house from very early on, my oldest is now 10, but the phrase that's been banned in our house very early was, that's not fair. That's not fair is completely inapplicable. Because guess what? This is a dictatorship, not a democracy. And fair doesn't come into it. Fair is your perception of how the outcome should work. It is not a reality. And again, that goes to a set of societal values. And I really do think that because we don't have as many kids in the society anymore,
yes,
people do not have a set of values that is geared toward the raising of children. You know, another friend, Tim Carney, recently wrote a book about the childlessness of Western culture, and he used as his counterexample Israel. He and I had talked about that before, and I said, you know, the only Western society that's currently reproducing at above replacement rates is Israel. And the reason for that is because that is a society where the entire structure of the society is built around setting rules for kids, such that when you go to a playground in Israel and a kid is acting badly, another person who is not a parent of the kid will literally tell the kid to stop it, which is something that is unheard of in the United States. If you are at a playground in the United States and one kid is bullying another kid, you first try to find the parent of the kid. And then if you can't find the parents of the kid, you try to remove your kid from the situation, probably because you're afraid of legal liability or because it's considered rude. In Israel, you'll have some random grandma who will just tell the kids to cut it out. And it's perfectly accepted because, again, when you have that many kids in the society, there need to be rules of the road that everybody sort of agrees on. And that just doesn't exist in the United States anymore.
Right. Absolutely right. And I actually talk a lot about Israel in the book because they do give kids a lot of things that are really good for mental health, like independence, genuine independence from age 8 and on. The kids all walk to school themselves, or get on a bus themselves. But I'll tell you something else. So why don't I focus on things like have more kids, stay married? Because yeah, those things are good, but are essential and important. But here's the thing. If you tell people have more kids, I don't know if they'll have them. But if you tell them, actually, here are the benefits, the mental health benefits of toughening your kids up. So I tried to look at the source code, you know, and go a little bit, in some sense deeper and look at, yes, more kids around is really good for everyone's mental health. Why? Because they realize they end up less fragile, less worried that they're going to fall apart if someone says something mean to them in school. And parents don't have the time to attend to every mean comment like it's a crisis and call it bullying and rush into school and change the child's seating just because one kid said something mean, right? So it's undeniable that, you know, people with, you know, bigger families, religious families, intact families, they provide so many mental health benefits to the kid. Just that structure, the outward focus, the more kids around, all that connection to grandparents, all that's very good for kids. But here's the thing that you know, a secular society, and America's increasingly secular, might not know. It's actually way better for your mental health to toughen you up a little bit than to sit around attending to every one of your problems. I know we think it's the gentler, nicer thing to do, but it is turning these kids into emotional basket cases.
Yeah, you mentioned there bullying briefly, and this has been one of my bugaboos for a long time, because one of the big things that people talk about when they talk about suicidal ideation among kids, they usually use this in context of gender dysphoria, for example, where the suggestion is that rates of suicidal ideation among gender dysphoric kids are high, specifically because everybody is mean to them and society is cruel and mean, and it can't be that maybe the kid was experiencing depression and confusion before and now has been social mediated into gender dysphoria or into faux gender dysphoria or rapid onset gender dysphoria. No, it's got to be that everybody is being really, really mean. And this has been a logic that you see used all the way up to and including the White House, is the idea that kids are effectively suicidally ideating because they are being bullied in school. Not only do I see no evidence that that's the case, I see a fair bit of counter evidence that's the case. Bullying in school has probably never been rarer in the United States than it currently is, specifically because the schools have been taught to crack down on it for both liability reasons and for mental health reasons. And second of all, when it comes to actual bullying, as somebody who's viciously bullied throughout my youth, I got to tell you, I don't believe it. I don't think that the evidence is there that if people are mean to you, that this is what typically makes people suicidal. I think that what makes people suicidal is something that goes far deeper than that. And this kind of notion that bullying, again, I'm not pro-bullying. Bullies should be punched in the teeth. In fact, one of the aspects of growing up is you learn to punch bullies in the teeth, which I think is a really, really important lesson to learn. It's one that I hope to teach my own kids, and am teaching my own kids. But this sort of idea that in order to avoid bullying, in order to avoid the hardships of life, and thus to lead you to health and happiness, we have to wipe out all the bad things that you're experiencing in life, and then dumb down bullying to include not just being punched in the face by a bully, but somebody saying a mean word to you or crossing you. That, as you say, is creating fragile kids.
Yeah, I mean, a few things. So I think you're generally right. The idea that there is bullying around LGBTQ identities is, in most of America is at this point laughable. It's the opposite. Kids feel so much pressure to identify as one of the LGBTQ labels. But, you know, is there a different kind of bullying? I think there is. I think that kids are tyrannizing each other with their feelings. We see on university campus the treatment of Jewish kids. I mean, that's a certain amount of bullying, but with the results you just said, which are you're seeing young Jewish, you know, co-eds come out and show more grit and more strength than I think we've ever seen. It's the opposite. A certain amount of heckling and harassment very often produces the stronger people. And not, of course, to condone any of that, it's abhorrent. But the point is that the hysteria that we all feel, I mean, I do think that's part of why we have fewer kids in this country. More kids are great. I love Carney's book, but we need to have more kids by taking the pressure off parents who are right now frantic that anytime a child's teased, they could have trauma. And this trauma will last a lifetime. It's not true. It's a lie. And the research does not support that trauma myth. But parents need to know that.
Yeah, one of the things you're talking about there, which is the ease of parenting, you're totally right about this. It is very, very stressful to be a modern parent where your job is to alleviate every single problem that your kid has. Whereas in the past, having kids basically meant, okay, they go to school, they are expected to do their homework when they come home, and then they're expected to go out in the sunshine until it gets dark, and then they're expected to eat what you put on the table and go to bed, which was, you know, the way that most people were raised for most of human history, actually. You know, the kind of nouveau parenting where you're expected to hover around your kids and be on them at all times, is incredibly stressful. It's really, really difficult. And my wife at one point joked about writing a book called I'm a Bad Mother and So Are You, meaning like the meaning that the basic kind of concept is that no one can abide by these standards.
Right.
And parents talk about this way, about this to each other all the time. Being a parent is difficult. Kids are a giant pain in the ass. They really are. They're very difficult. They're wonderful and they're terrific. And also they're a giant pain in the ass. They're a huge time suck. And all of that is true, but it makes it even worse when what you feel is that every single ding on the brand new Mercedes-Benz that is your child is going to wreck the entire value of the car and can't be ironed out.
I think that's why kids became a pain in the ass, by the way. It's because we made it so labor intensive to hover. I mean, you listen to these gentle parenting, you know, these therapeutic parenting experts. I listened to one just the other day, and they say if your child is demanding that the family watch a different movie, this is the example I heard just yesterday, not the movie you want, but a different movie, and they're throwing a tantrum, you pick them up, carry them to their room and sit there with them for a half an hour to an hour until they calm down. Now, if you have, you can't do that if you have more than one child. Now you're not disciplining, you're being their slave. But this is the kind of advice parents get all the time, and it makes having more kids feel impossible.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've seen in some of the parenting books is this thing where your kid's fussing, your kid's having a meltdown, a tantrum, and you're supposed to say to them, I see you're feeling sad, aren't you? I see you're feeling really angry, aren't you? So we tried that one time with my oldest daughter. And the problem is that she's smart. So she immediately, she basically, not in these words, said, why are you patronizing me? Like, yes, I know I'm angry. Yes, I know I'm sad. Like, I don't need you repeating it back to me to feel that. What she really wanted was for us to say, okay, well, until you can calm down, you're going to be in this room and we're going to be in that room. When you calm down, come on back out and then hang out with us. It's this sort of mirroring effect also. It feels like, you know, it's not just kind of this gentle parenting. It's this empathetic parenting. It's all about empathy with the child. Well, I mean, I don't think that I ought to empathize with what are essentially small, crazy people. I mean, I've said to my wife before that being a parent is like running an insane asylum. Half the time the kids are wonderful and you're enjoying it. And then half the time they're melting down for legitimately no reason. And that's okay. That's okay. And you're supposed to deal with that.
And there's something else too that this is kind of a radical statement, but it's so, I think it's very obviously too. And, you know, I can talk about why, but the idea that you're supposed to validate all of your child's, you know, feelings is ridiculous. Now with, you have to educate a child's feelings a little bit. Now that's different. That's why therapy is so different for adults. It's one of the many reasons. An adult may want a safe space or whatever it is to just vent, and a non-judgmental space in which to vent their worries or feelings without being judged. And you know what? That's your prerogative. But a five-year-old who feels rage that he was served mac and cheese when he wanted a different meal for lunch and throws the bowl at mom needs to be told that is not, first of all, that the behavior is unacceptable. He has to have a consequence. And he also has to be told that's not a reason for anger. That's not a reason for anger. We can be angry at a lot of things. That's an inappropriate reaction.
We'll get to more on this in a moment. First, who doesn't love a great comeback story, especially when it's my favorite meat company bringing back their price lock guarantee? Yes, it is true. Good Ranchers price lock guarantee, it's back. It's the exclusive price lock on 100% American meat. This is your last chance to subscribe and have Good Ranchers secure your price, shielding you from inflation until 2026. It's as easy as subscribing to any of their American meat boxes. Once you do, your price is guaranteed against inflation for a solid 18 months. GoodRanchers.com is where I get the most tender, flavorful meat. With options like beef, chicken, pork, and wild-caught seafood, they have something for even the pickiest of eaters. What I really love about Good Ranchers is their commitment to transparency. They believe you have the right to know exactly what's in your food. They're amazing supporters of this show, so go support them. Take the mystery out of all the meat you buy. Right now, when you go to GoodRanchers.com and use promo code Shapiro, you'll get their exclusive price shield and an additional 10% off your order. This is the last week to secure the best price on meat until 2026. Go to GoodRanchers.com. Use my code Shapiro. That's GoodRanchers.com with promo code Shapiro today. In many ways, you know, one of the things that's happening also is the, as you say, it's creating a countervailing response in kids that's significantly worse because, you know, as we say, you have kids, I have kids. What kids want more than anything else is parental attention. It's the thing they desperately want, parental attention. And they will get it negative or they will get it positive. They don't really care. They would prefer to have negative parental attention than no attention. And the worst thing the worst punishment we use with some of our kids is we say, I'm going to ignore you until you actually start acting like a rational human being and deprive you of that attention because very often kids want the fight because they'd rather have the fight with you than to be ignored completely. But what we do when we engage in these sorts of, okay, we're going to validate your feelings, you're actually encouraging them to feel bad in order to get your attention for feeling bad, which, I mean, you see this with your adult friends too. There are people who just love being depressed because they can't wait to tell their friends about how depressed they are and how terrible their life is because, you know, that's what's fun is you get to go out to brunch and then talk about how terrible your life is. Nobody likes these friends, and you're creating these adults out of your children when you do this sort of stuff.
That's right. You're making kids more dysregulated. And by the way, there's really good research going back to the 1960s by Diana Bomarend and showing that authoritative parents, rule-based parenting, loving but rule-based, always produce the happiest, most successful, and kids with the best relationship with mom and dad. Not authoritarian, which is cold, obedience is everything. By the way, it doesn't exist in America. It's now just a complete straw man whenever they bring it up. That's authoritarian parenting, and not permissive. And we don't have that anymore either. We have this surveillance parenting, this hysterical therapeutic surveillance parenting, which has all the detriments of permissive parenting minus the independence. We never give kids independence and they need it. They need to be trusted with knives at some point. Otherwise, they're going to be like animals in a cage, and that's what they are. You brought up Jonathan Haidt, and I certainly love his hypothesis, and we agree about so much. But one of the things that I'm worried about with this generation is not just their levels of distress, which is very alarming, but also their lack of sense of efficacy that they can do in the world. And we've never seen kids at such high rates, young adults now, saying they don't feel they can improve their lives, that things they do matter. And that's why I think there are no tech founders in this generation so far. So we need to reorient, you know, the way these kids are being raised. And part of that means we need to get the experts out of the room so that they stop undermining parents' sense that they know what's best for their own kids.
So one of the most surprising things that you talk about in the book, you talked about it on Joe's show as well, was some of your findings with regard to the statistics on suicidality among people who claim gender dysphoria. You had suggested that actually it is not radically higher than other segments of the teenage population when you remove other factors. I wanted you to kind of explicate that and explain what you mean by that.
Sure. This was the more recent study out of, I think, Finland, which said that when you control for other comorbidities, other psychological, you know, problems, the rates of suicidality among transgender identified youth are not higher than they are for the adolescents more generally. So look, you know, these kids, part of the reason a lot of them are attracted to the idea that they might be transgender is they have a lot of mental health struggles at the same time. And the question is the transgender or the gender dysphoria, the severe discomfort in the biological sense, is in the biological sex, is that driving the misery? Actually, it turns out not to be. And so, you know, predictably, transition, gender transition is no cure for it.
So let's talk about some of the cures that you recommend here. So obviously we kind of know who the villains are. We know on a general level, but let's get more specific about that. So when you look at the educational system or you look at the medical system, if you were going to target institutions to change, which would be kind of top of the list for you?
Schools. Schools have to shrink mental health staff right now. What they are doing is they are obsessing with children. I just got an email just yesterday from a friend whose daughter is in public school. And I talk about in the book the really horrifying CDC authored suicide studies, mental health surveys, mental health surveys that the kids across the country are routinely taking. Her daughter said she was getting them weekly. How is your mental health? How is your mental health now? Have you considered cutting? Have you considered burning, choking? Have you ever played this game? Over and over and over. These kids are so oppressively, you know, being asked about whether they're thinking about suicide, whether it's presented as a coping mechanism. It's, you know, having mental health struggles is valorized in schools with the counselors who are constantly checking in. And these surveys are a disaster, but so are the mental health staffs who are always directing these. They're directing social emotional learning. They're constantly obsessing over kids' bad feelings. And it's way too much for kids.
When it comes to these schools and the staffs, you know, school therapists, how often are they actually, say, medical psychiatrists as opposed to, you know, just somebody who got a degree in therapy?
Yeah. So almost never. What they are is they usually get a 1-year accreditation as a school counselor, and they're leading kids in exercises like social emotional learning. Now, what is social emotional learning? It sounds great. The idea is to teach kids emotional regulation techniques. That's the idea. And who wouldn't want that, right? So kids are more self-aware and more courteous to each other. I mean, that's how they sell it. But for reasons I explain in the book, what it does is if you're going to teach emotional regulation, invariably the conversation turns to negative feelings. Why? Because if you're asking kids, what was a time when you were happy? There's nothing to teach. So it's always asking kids, what's a time when you felt left out, bullied, traumatized, when you felt alone or misunderstood? And it's getting kids to ruminate on their bad feelings. This is, again, the number one symptom of depression. And of course, it also tees up a criticism of the parents. Why? Because whose job was it to keep the child safe? So invariably, the question is, well, where was your mom? Where was your dad? So this kind of social emotional learning, for those reasons, that feelings focus leads to kids who are more dysregulated. Now, as I was writing the book, I predicted all of this. I explained why I thought this was really bad for kids based on the research. But what I didn't know was while I was thinking this, two teams of researchers in Europe were thinking the same, and they were testing it. So a team of researchers in Australia evaluated something called the Wise Teens Program. This was social emotional techniques offered to kids in school in Australia. And another team of researchers was doing a meta-analysis of these techniques in England. Everything from anti-bullying techniques to wellness tips to social emotional techniques. And in both sets of studies, they concluded the same. Kids, as opposed to control group that did not go through the program, the teenagers who went through the program emerged more anxious, more depressed, and more alienated from mom and dad.
Yeah, it really is amazing that there's this bizarre bifurcation in how we think about kids in America and in Europe as well. There, on the one hand, we treat kids as absolutely fragile, got to be super careful not to scratch or dent them. On the other hand, we pour all this stuff into their heads with the assumption that they can't be damaged. And as you mentioned, I mean, if you keep asking a kid over and over and over about, say, their gender identity or whether they feel depressed or whether they've ever thought about cutting, you are implanting ideas in kids' heads. I mean, this is, in fact, how you actually get kids to think in a particular way. They're unbelievably malleable at this age. And so when you point this out to people, say, well, are you saying that if you just keep saying this stuff to kids, then they might start actually doing this sort of stuff? What? The answer is yes. If you keep saying things to kids, they will end up doing this sort of stuff. And by the way, we actually do know that from the best social research with regard to suicidal ideation. It turns out that suicide is actually fairly contagious, and that when you continue to tell kids in a particular social circle that one kid has committed suicide, have you thought about committing suicide? Have you thought about if you do that, this is why, you know, there's been a crackdown on social media, for example, on talking about suicide specifically because of the social contagions that can occur. But when it comes to politically correct diseases, then all of a sudden there's no social contagion at all. Then if you say, for example, that gender dysphoria is socially contagious, which it clearly is, then that it's always been that way. When you say, well, you know, it's weird because if you go a couple generations ago and you can look at it on the age spectrum, people above the age of 60 in this country, less than 1% are going to openly identify as LGBTQ+. And when you look at people who are below the age of 20, you're looking at probably a quarter of the population now. That doesn't seem like an evolutionary bottleneck. That seems like a social... Nope. It can't be that if you keep speaking into people's brains over and over, it has any impact on their brains. So on the one hand, highly, highly bubble-wrapped, don't let anything touch them. On the other hand, we will pour as much toxic nonsense in your ears as we possibly can under the assumption that it will have no impact.
And it will fly under the flag of mental health. That's the thing. That's why I don't think it's just a smartphone again, because teens are identifying with their diagnoses. It's not just they feel limited by the way, there's a classic effect of, you know, diagnosis is that a side effect is that you feel limited by that diagnosis. Now you feel like you can't change. You need a pill or you need a therapist to help you. And we're seeing that these kids are absolutely convinced they're depressed. Over half of the rising generation thinks their mental health is not good. We've never seen these numbers. And why? Exactly what you're saying. We're constantly suggesting to kids that they might be depressed. Now, here's the funny thing. You said you're right. We know, and the CDC came out with, as you know, and others have issued reports on what makes suicide contagious, things like presenting it as a coping mechanism, things like, you know, normalizing it and valorizing the subject. This is all stuff that we know we're not supposed to do in the media. But mental health, you know, so-called experts in schools, the school counselors are doing this all the time. And again, these surveys are now given out by pediatricians. They're authored by the CDC, and they're given out in school, and they're constantly presenting a world to children that is dark, where kids are constantly engaging in self-harm, where their mental health is so shaky. We're telling kids that the kids around them are barely getting by. And by the way, how are you doing?
Folks, as Mother's Day approaches, I want to highlight an organization that cares deeply for moms. That is Preborn. Preborn's network of clinics exists exclusively to offer love, life, and support to pregnant women. They care for women who feel scared and alone and are being pressured to make the ultimate choice that will not only sacrifice the life of their preborn baby, but also take a piece of their heart. When a distressed mom comes to Preborn, she's welcomed with open arms and offered a free ultrasound to hear and see the precious life growing inside her. Many times, she will choose life. This Mother's Day, you can help bring life to both a mother in need and a baby at risk. If you have the means and would like to sponsor an ultrasound, one ultrasound is only $28. Every penny goes toward loving moms and babies. And when you become a monthly sponsor, you'll receive pictures and stories of lives you helped to save. To get involved, simply dial #250 and say keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/Ben. That's preborn.com/Ben. It's the best thing you're going to do all day, all week, all month. Check them out right now. Dial #250, say keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/Ben to start saving lives today. So again, we talked about the schools. When it comes to sort of the professionals outside of school, what changes need to happen there? Because there's a pipeline that exists, obviously. We're in the school therapist with a one-year degree that is virtually meaningless, decides that they now know how to diagnose mental health problems. Then they funnel that person to an actual psychologist. And then people say, okay, well, a psychologist is a doctor. That person went to actual medical school or at least to PsyD. You know, they at least have some sort of background in this. But it seems like the psychology profession has also become unbelievably captured by a lot of this ideology.
So what I want to do is reset the default settings. Parents, at the first sign of children's distress, should not drop off their children with a therapist, especially if they're able to stabilize a child through other environmental changes, right? If your child has a severe problem, OCD, for example, as you mentioned, or anorexia, and you can't stabilize them other way, then by all means, the question now becomes, what kind of treatment? Should it be something like cognitive behavioral therapy? But dropping a kid off at the first sign of trouble or a first sign of distress with a psychodynamic psychotherapist who's going to sit around and talking about their trauma, they might end up with exactly what we're seeing, a population that feels that is nursing every injury, nursing every emotional hurt. I mean, in the book, I argue that they're basically emotional hypochondriacs, which doesn't mean they're faking it. That's not what hypochondriasis is. It's not what they now call illness anxiety disorder. It's not what it is. It's people who apply a hyper-focus to their problems, in this case, their emotional problems, and thereby magnify those problems to the point where they're experiencing so much distress, they don't want to show up for work.
So how did all of this get started? The over-diagnosis, the over-therapying, was this a money game or was this an ideological game?
So Frank Furedi he's a wonderful British sociologist. He argues this has been, you know, a steady march across the West of professionalizing all relationships. I think it's very compelling what he says, that we have this natural, you know, mistrust of informal relationships. And we try to professionalize it. And that's why parents think they need to ape therapists in talking to their own kids. God forbid you were ever natural with your child, right? And as you said about your daughter, she knows when she's being patronized. When your mom's pretending to be a shrink, the kid knows it, right? When they're saying, I'm setting a boundary, or, you know, this sort of language where they're so obviously aping the shrink or aping the therapist, it creates this incredibly unnatural relationship. And we want natural relationships in the home, which doesn't, you know, of course, parents aren't supposed to be their kids' friends. They're supposed to be authorities, but they also want to be natural, which means their own sense of humor, their own values should prevail. I think that march has been going on for the last 50 years, the sense that, you know, you can't trust people to their own informal relationships. We need to hire experts to get in there and fix them.
You know, one of the things that is kind of amazing is just that parents are now expected, because as you talk about, there's this professional relationship that's supposed to attend on being a parent. You're actually not socializing your kids properly at all, because a professional is paid to have a relationship with you. A professional is somebody who is going to put their own personal reaction to what you are doing aside in order to deal with you. You are the center of their world. If I hire somebody to do a job, I'm the client, they're the professional. That's the way it works. But what families used to be was a place where socialization actually happened. You see this largely among siblings, right? Siblings treat each other like crap half the time. I mean, they really do. I mean, and every single family, they love each other and they protect each other and they protect from outside threat. And also they bully each other and they say mean things to each other and they fight with each other. That's just like, that's normal. And it's a really good socializing thing because that is how the world works. And as a parent, if your kid is being really terrible and you display a little bit of anger with regard to your kid, everybody treats that as though that's the worst thing in the world. I'm not so sure that that's the worst thing in the world, given the fact that in the real world, if you act badly, you will be met with anger. And this idea that it's everybody else's job to sort of respond to your feelings in the way you wish to be responded to, that you're upset, you're throwing a tantrum, and everybody is then supposed to cave to you, as opposed to reacting how actually the rest of the world normally will, you know, that is not socializing your kid at all. It's doing the reverse.
That's exactly right. And what happens is these kids that show up after being so accommodated by their parents, so gently treated on expert advice, they can't sit still and they end up medicated. That's what we do because we can't get them to govern themselves, because to do that, you have to set down rules and consequences. And we call that gentler. It's not gentler to go in there and rework your child's personality medically and make them feel that they have a brain problem when they don't, when they just haven't learned to govern themselves. You know, you mentioned extended family. That's one of the things we don't give kids. And here's the secret. If a child, exactly like you said, you send a kid off to a therapist, a psychodynamic therapist, a kid who doesn't have a serious problem, and they're going to explore everything that might be the cause. And you're going to find out, and I've heard this again and again, that the child was nursing, you know, some, you know, purported hurt that happened years ago that was extremely minor, but the therapist is paid to rehash it with them ad infinitum. But, you know, if a child brings their problem to an aunt or a cousin or an uncle, you know, there's a limit for how long the child will be allowed to go on. At some point, they'll say, not only will the person be incentivized to reinforce your values, but at some point they'll say, go play. Go play. Yes, your sister hit you. It's not the end of the world. Go play. I'm sorry. The therapist will never say, go play. So the endless rumination never stops.
You know, the endless treating of people as though they are 2 years old has obviously had radical ramifications for the society at large, not just for kids, but for adults. And I'm picking two as sort of the reason, because when kids are two, you can't reason with them. I mean, when kids are two, you can't actually tell them their feelings aren't valid because they literally don't understand anything when they're two. They're two. And so we treat 6 years old like they're two. We treat 15-year-olds like they're two. And now we're treating 25 and 30-year-olds like they're two. And so what you have are, you know, just this week, employees at Google, which is an incredibly successful and powerful corporation, probably the most powerful corporation on the planet. Employees at Google staking out their boss's office, occupying their boss's office to try to get Google to somehow remove its investments from cloud services for the Israeli military in the belief that it's the job of the Google CEO to validate their feelings and make them feel better about their own political priors. And what's even more amazing is how many of these corporations are deciding to go along with this. This is the part that I don't understand. There was always a feeling, at least until the last few years, there's always a feeling that, okay, so we're doing all this crap and it's really stupid. And then there will come a point where somebody becomes an adult and the real world will clock them in the face. And it turns out that when you educate an entire generation this way, almost universally, they don't even know how to break the cycle. The cycle just continues. So instead of the CEO of Google just saying, okay, well, you're here, you're all fired, which is what a normal CEO would do, they'll be, okay, how can we bargain with you? I want to validate your feelings, make you feel better about yourself. And the world gets worse.
Well, you know, I'm going to say something kind of funny here. And that is that, you know, just, I hate to be on the side of defending the CEO of Google, but a 25-year-old who's throwing a temper tantrum is scary. It's really different than a 2-year-old. And that's what we've got. We've got 25-year-olds together throwing temper tantrums. And, you know, as I say in the book, it's the reason they don't want to grow up. They don't feel up to it. We've got 25-year-old basket cases who don't know how to govern themselves, don't know that there's a world outside of their feelings that's more important. And they are acting truly like overgrown toddlers.
And that has ramifications for the next generation. We're talking about the current young generation, but there's another generation that just is not going to exist because of this. Because it turns out that one of the predicates to becoming a parent is actually getting outside yourself. In fact, that's most of what being a parent is getting outside yourself. It's most of what being married is forming a relationship with another human being where the marriage is above both of you and the institution is more important than either of you and the relationship is more important than whatever you're feeling in the moment. No one has ever wanted to do the dishes or take out the garbage, but you do it anyway because that's what you are supposed to do. And if you are not prepared to make that sort of commitment, and then if you're not prepared to make the far fuller and more demanding commitment of actually raising another human being to be a responsible human being, then what's going to happen is what is happening, which is people are not forming relationships. They're reverting to pornography or to bots or to 900 number, whatever it is. So they won't form a relationship. And then even if they do, it'll be sort of a bizarre, angsty teenage relationship. Like, this has been one of my critiques of pop culture for a long time, is Taylor Swift is almost as old as I am, and she's still writing songs like she's a 16-year-old girl about her latest breakup. And it's like, Taylor Swift is the same age as my wife. My wife is a doctor with four children. I don't know in what world you get to be an angsty teenager when you're 34, 35 years old. Like, at a certain point, like, there in human history, that was a point where some women were grandmothers. Like, I don't even know what we're talking about here. But that is the entire generation we've created. And what that means, that there's another generation that simply is not going to exist. I think this does contribute in a sort of backward way to the Tim Carney point, which is that people who are not capable of having kids just will not have kids.
And here's the other thing. Here's the secret in my view, and that is that growing up, taking on responsibilities, is actually the solution to a lot of teenage angst. Thinking of others, doing for others, having that outward focus actually makes you feel less angsty about your own situation. And not only are they not being raised to feel ready for that, they don't feel up to it. They are so focused on themselves. And I totally agree with you. Of all the things I worry about, the rising generation, I think, you know, and I have kids, I think about my own kids. Of all the things that looks hard growing up today, the hardest looks dating. Because when you have a population so focused on itself and its own feelings, as you said, forming a family with such people looks almost impossible.
Yeah, I think this is also one of the reasons why you see differential rates, as you mentioned, other countries, of happiness among young people in other countries. The more, as you say, the more responsibility you give to young people, the happier they are, actually. I mean, kids are actually looking for responsibilities. They want to be given, they want to be treated as people who are capable of carrying forward those responsibilities. We've actually given our kids, in some ways, the worst message, which is follow your dream, no responsibilities. When the reality is, what most people are looking for is a place in life. They're looking for a thing to do. They're looking for an actual program that is going to bring them meaning in their lives. And you see that in places around the world where there is a program for bringing meaning in their lives. So I'm going to take the example of Israel again, just because it's the one I'm most familiar with. In Israel, when you're 18 years old, you go and do national service and you go to the army. And that is a radical burden. I mean, you literally stop your life and you go to a place where you might be killed. I mean, right now they're at war. And yet young people in Israel are significantly happier by the numbers than young people in the United States, where they have no such burdens. There's no drafts. You're not expected to do anything. The federal government might relieve your student loans. You can go major in something completely useless. But in Israel, you are expected to contribute immediately upon hitting the age of 18. And then when you're done with that, you're expected to get a job and you're expected to get married and you're expected to have kids and you're expected to contribute to the community and to the nation. And we've lost that. That used to be the way it was in the United States also. I mean, if you go back to the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, that was the way that it was. If you were a young person, it's not that you were expected to go to the military because there wasn't a draft until the late 30s, but you were expected to get a job. The understanding was that as you graduated high school, you were either going to college to get better credential to get a job, or you were going to go out and start supporting your family and go get a job and move out of the house right now. And you're expected to get married. And as we keep delaying this sort of stuff, it's not that people are getting happy. Right. It turns out that we now have, you know, what my friend Jordan Peterson would say is choice paralysis. We're faced with an enormous, you can do anything you want. Well, what if I don't want to do any of those things because I don't know which one of those things to choose?
Right. So what can American parents do? Start with chores. Chores is a great way to give kids independence and a sense that they are contributing to the greater good, which, by the way, is amazing for the mental health. Look, exactly what you said in the book. You know, I compare other cultures who are doing better than American kids. One of them is Israel, in terms of things like anxiety and depression. and they're on the same smartphones. But what they are doing, as you said, is they have to grow up. They have to take on responsibility for someone besides themselves. And we have divested American kids of this in two ways. One, we have to give them chores. We don't give them any responsibility. We don't give them any independence. We need to. They have to be sent to the store or to work on a project that will better the family. Okay. So these types of things are really good. But here's the other thing we don't do. In our trauma-obsessed culture, we're afraid to tell them what their grandparents and great-grandparents went through because we're so afraid of traumatizing them. What they need to be told is your grandparents and great-grandparents, they've gotten through really hard things and you can too.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I think just as a society we've lost. We call them first world problems, but they're really not even first world problems. They're just modern problems. And the modern problems are so much lower in scale and scope than anything that our predecessors had to face. This is why when I see young people and they say, I don't have any hope for the future. I mean, your present right now is better than anything that your grandparents ever experienced for their entire life if they died anytime in the last 20 years. And the bizarre notion that you're experiencing at the richest time in human history, this suffering that is absolutely cataclysmic is amazing. And I think that it's actually tearing apart the country. It's the reason why people go to catastrophism, because if they don't feel responsibility and they don't know a way to go, I think, you know, one of the kind of bizarre kind of side effects of that is you end up with a lot of literature and movies that are all about sort of the post-apocalyptic era, in the sense that those are very simple decisions, right? Now the question is, do you eat, do you not eat? I think people are so thirsty and hungry for simpler choices because there is no choice matrix that they're consuming literature that is largely about making extremely simple choices in limited circumstances. And when you're pining for that, it's not long until you get there because you're going to make those circumstances for yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I always ask people, you know, to tell me about their grandparents or great grandparents, because invariably the story is one of privation. It's one of poverty. It's one of all kinds of hardship. And I tell the story in the book of my own grandmother, who was born in 1927 and to, you know, a poor family of immigrants, and her mother died in childbirth. She eventually was raised by an older sister because her father had four kids and couldn't take care of all of them. And she was raised by her older sister. She then got polio and spent a year in an iron lung. And she ended up not only married to my grandfather, she went off to college, but she ended up one of the happiest, most grateful people I've ever known. And the idea that she wouldn't be able to form a family never entered her head. Okay. And the idea that somehow that she had been permanently marked by a year of isolation, which she had, and it was real isolation. It was in an iron lung. It wasn't like, you know, being, you know, lockdowns, which were, you know, obviously very hard on kids. But the idea that she couldn't recover never entered her mind, probably because no team of counselors suggested to her that she had childhood trauma.
Okay, well, Abigail, if you're going to give a final note to parents as we leave here, what is your sort of final note to parents who are just thinking of where to put their kids in schools? How should they make that decision?
So, gosh, I would say, number one, parental authority. Kids need your authority. So wherever you're going to send them, make sure they know your values, that you're in charge, that you know what's best for them, and make sure that we communicate our values to our kids. We're doing a lousy job of that in the country, and we send them off to school where teachers can't wait to pass on their values to your kids. So don't let that happen. They need more independence. They need more chores. You have to give them a sense of meaning and extended family and siblings. That's all really, really good for kids. And the final thing I'll just say is everyone's obsessed with making kids happy. We should be more focused on making them strong. If you make them strong, they will be happy.
Abigail Schreier, I really appreciate the time. The book is fantastic. Go check it out right now. Bad Therapy, available everywhere. Thanks, Abigail.
Thank you.
Ben Shapiro's Sunday Special is produced by Savannah Morris and Matt Kemp. Associate producers are Jake Pollock and John Crick. Editing is by Chris Ridge. Audio is mixed by Mike Corimina. Camera and lighting is by Zach Ginta. Hair, makeup, and wardrobe by Fabiola Cristina. Title graphics are by Cynthia Angulo. Executive assistant, Kelly Carvalho. Executive in charge of production is David Wormis. Executive producer, Justin Siegel. Executive producer, Jeremy Boring. The Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special is a Daily Wire production. Copyright Daily Wire 2024.